Something that maybe many of you do not know about me is that I actually took piano lessons for about 10 years. And I know, and you're like, how can he not have any musical ability in his body? But, you know, for a while during my middle school and I think elementary to high school years, I actually had to take what many of you are familiar with who are, you know, into music, what's called the Certificate of Merit test. If some of you have ever taken, some of you are groaning, and I can see the internal groanings and sighs of your slavery. I understand, and it's kind of a test that you take every year that where you go and you do all this theory stuff so that you understand all the technicals of piano music, as well as having to perform like a piece from every type of genre of music. They test you on your sight reading, which is they put, you know, music that you've never practiced before in front of you, and you have to simply play it to demonstrate your ability, et cetera, et cetera. And I got to tell you, I was always a nervous wreck about this kind of stuff. But one year, I actually had the great privilege of doing well enough that I was selected to perform in what's called the Branch Honors Recital. Some of you have that privilege. Probably some of you are so good, you probably do that over and over. But for me, it was a big deal. Now, if you've ever performed in a recital before, what is the number one rule? Does anybody know? Yes, you do have to memorize it. Don't mess up is a good one. But that's not the number one rule. The number one rule at a recital is, if you mess up, keep on going. That's correct. That's right. And so I have to tell you, that was like a big deal for me. I didn't realize how nervous I was going to be. I kept looking at, you know, the panelist judges and the people there. My piano teacher was there. My parents were there. And I tell you, for a young man, I didn't know that I could sweat that much. And so kept looking up at the people, and I knew the piece that was selected was one I had a lot of trouble with. And so I was playing this song, and I knew that there's one spot that I always messed up during my practice time, during the times I was with my teacher, and for some reason, when I performed it during the test, I did fine. So I thought, okay, you know, I've done it fine once, and I've practiced this probably a million times, and no problem. And so as I started coming closer and closer to that spot in the music, I could feel myself starting to sweat. Don't blow it. Don't blow it. And of course, right at that moment, my mind went blank. My fingers, you know, sometimes you, for those of you who do music, your fingers just get kind of go on autopilot and you can just kind of, you practice it so many times you can just do it. But for some reason, I totally blanked out and I just stopped. Dead silence in the middle of this recital. I didn't know what to do. So what did I do? I started over from the beginning of the song. Kept playing again. Came to that spot. Got stuck, dead silence, didn't know what to do, started over a third time from the beginning, and I kept playing, got to that spot again, my mind, and at this point, you know, my heart is like, and I am starting to flip out inside. People, you know, on the surface, like, I'm doing that old piano thing where you're trying to look expressive and musical, but inside I'm screaming, ah, you know, like, just waiting for this torture to be over, because I know that everybody in the room thinks I'm an idiot at this point, because I've broken the cardinal rule 3 times. And so at this point, I reached that point one more time. And you're thinking like, is this story going to end well for him? It doesn't end well. I get to that point, and I just can't do it. I stop, and I give up. I stop at that point, get up, take a bow, and go take my seat. And I have to tell you, that moment, I wanted to crawl under a rock because I felt all of the pressure, the expectations. I disappointed my teacher. I dishonored my family. You know, all this kind of stuff going on. And I have to tell you, fear is a powerful form of enslavement. And particularly fear about people, what people will think of me, what they'll say about me, what they'll do to you. And so if you have a Bible, I want you to turn in it to Exodus chapter 1. As you know, we're in this series called Unbound, and we're seeing how God moves people from slavery to his promised land, and for us, from our slavery to his promises. And the goal here, as we study the book of Exodus, and what we see as the primary theme throughout this whole book, is that as people encounter the God of glory, he sets them free to worship him, to enjoy him, and to become his people together. And you remember from last week, I mentioned to you that the reality is that all of us are slaves. We are already serving someone or something. We are subject to someone or something. And so there's areas in our thought life, in our behavior that we can't control or that we feel out of control. We bow to some kind of master, whether it is materialism and greed, maybe it's sin and addiction, comfort, security, pleasure, performance, and people-pleasing, which we're going to talk about today, being judgmental and angry, worry, depression, loneliness, relationships, and that even if you think that you're independent, that you can do what you want, you're still not free. Because what you really serve, if you're that type of mentality, is your impulses, that you're a slave to them. I can do what I want, so I'm going to go do this and that, and you're a slave to your impulses and your selfishness, or maybe your pride and self-centeredness. But what God offers is an alternative, that you can be unbound from the temporary, futile, destructive slavery of this world, and instead serve and worship Him as a different kind of master, a life-giving one, because we're going to serve someone or something, but we can serve a life-giving master in what the Bible calls a covenant in Exodus, which is a binding agreement between God and His people. Because you remember I said that freedom isn't the ability to do whatever you want, because then you're just a slave, like I said, to your selfishness and sinfulness. But freedom is when we are set free to experience God and His life-giving ways, His fulfilling and everlasting ways as His people, as His children. And so Exodus starts out in chapter 1 with two related accounts about people who will face fears about people. And one ends in slavery to that fear, but the other account is when people get set free. So let's look. I'm going to blaze through the beginning of the passage. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah; Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin; Dan and Naphtali; Gad and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. So 70 people came to Egypt originally from the Hebrew, or from this family. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. I want you to hear those words: fruitful, increased greatly, multiplied, grew strong, land was filled. You see, what's happening here is Exodus is kind of recounting some history. It's picking up where Genesis left off. Remember what I talked about last week, that Genesis has the hope of God blessing mankind through Abraham and his descendants, and that it culminates in God elevating Abe's great-grandson, Joseph, to deliver his 11 brothers out from death and suffering from famine and under the protection of God by relocating them in the land of Egypt. But what's happening here is by Exodus, those 12 families of Joseph's brothers have grown into 12 tribes of people. In verse 6, those 70 original descendants of Jacob have increased, we know in Exodus chapter 12, to over a million strong at this point. And in verse 7, what we're seeing here is the fulfillment of God's will, starting from Adam and Eve. Do you remember those early commands that God gave them? Be fruitful, multiply, fill the land, Genesis 1:28. And so the Hebrew people, they're experiencing the blessings and the promises of God, but their circumstances are about to turn. They're going to become enslaved. And the lesson here is that in this life, circumstances can seem to move from a season of blessed to oppressed very quickly, can't they? And our problem is that we tend only to see the short-term view of whether a blessing or oppression. That blessing seems to go away, or oppression comes, and we only see it, we only see that. And so we tend to have a short-term view instead of trusting God's long-term view that our suffering is temporary, that His ultimate blessing, His lasting inheritance will come in accordance with His word, by His grace, through faith. And so, how do we respond when life seems to move from blessed to oppressed? Are you enslaved by the fear of short-term circumstances or people in your life? Do you let it rule over you? Or do you have a long-term trust in God? And so we're going to look at a negative and positive example of this and hopefully begin the process of being set free from our slavery to fear of people. Let's move on to verse 8. Now, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply." And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel, so they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. So what we're seeing here is a literal slavery of the people of Israel. And in verse 8, we see that there's a new boss in town and that the friendship between Joe and the kings of Egypt is long forgotten. That how God not only blessed Joseph's family, but he also protected and blessed all of Egypt through them, protected them from the famine that we saw in Genesis 41. And so what we're seeing here is how does this new king, this Pharaoh, respond to a time of pressure and challenges and overruling the people? And in verse 9, he looks out at this million-strong Hebrew Israelite people, I'm going to use those interchangeably, and says, there's too many. They're too strong. If they decide they don't like us Egyptians anymore, they'd whoop us and take over the land, right? And what's interesting is he doesn't think about what a blessing that their God has sent to us Egyptians, that these Hebrew people, they moved into our communities, they don't commit any crimes, they don't borrow money or owe us money or leech off of us, they contribute to society, they're good neighbors. He's not thankful, he doesn't reflect on how God sent them to bless both the Hebrew people and preserve them, but also to bless the Egyptian people as well. So even though God is clearly with the Israelite people, we see that as they continue to increase, even though they haven't done anything against him personally or against Egypt nationally, he's only concerned about how the Israelites might pose a threat to his own power base, to his influence, to his rule. You see, Pharaoh is driven more by fear of men than by fear of God. You see, let me give you a definition. We're talking about this issue of the fear of men this morning and the slavery that comes with it. That's when we fear about what others think or feel about us, what they say about us or do to us. And when those things control what we think, what we feel, what we say, or what we do. Let me say that again. It's when what other people think, feel, say, or do controls what we think, feel, say, and do. How we react, the choices we make, the actions that we'll take. And the problem with that, as you remember, in Proverbs chapter 29, verse 25, God tells us that the fear of man is a trap or a snare, depending on your translation. That idea that it's both harmful and a prison, that it can be deadly in the spiritual sense, and that it's a type of enslavement. This Christian counselor named Ed Welch, he wrote a book called When People Are Big and God Is Small. And he says that when we talk about fear of people, it's, yes, fear in the biblical sense includes being afraid of somebody, but it also extends to holding them in awe or being controlled or mastered by people, what they think of you, how they're going to treat you. That it's a form of worship. And so when we talk about fear, I want you to equate that with the idea that it is a issue of worship. You see, when you fear men, we replace God with people. And so we're mastered by those people. They control us. We're serving them. We allow them to be lord over us. And that's expressed in the ways that we cave to peer pressure, the way that we are people pleasers, the way that we're codependent sometimes. And so we think towards people, I want to please them and appease them. That's fear and worship. They become more important of a relationship because what that person thinks matters more than what God thinks about me. And so we want them to bless us and accept us and approve us and to tell us, well done, good and faithful servant, to not reject us and disapprove of us and to never leave us or forsake us. Fear of men is an issue of worship and lordship. Is that you? Are you trapped and ensnared and enslaved by the fear of men? Well, let's find out by examining some of Pharaoh's symptoms. In verse 10, he basically says, we as a people, as Egyptians, we need to be careful. If war ever breaks out, these Israelites could side with our enemies so they can escape. Isn't that interesting? You see, he hasn't even enslaved the Hebrew people by that point, but he fears their escape because he already thinks of them as his resource, as his property to exploit. He doesn't want to lose them. He doesn't want them to escape. And what I want you to understand is when you have a fear of men, it's rooted in a fear of what that person can take away from you, what you stand to lose or what you will lose from them. So it reminds me of a young person. I asked permission to share this, but I won't share their name. Came into my office a week ago, and we were talking, and this person was sharing with me, you know what? I hated coming to church because I thought that Christians would be critical of me and judgmental of me. But it turns out that I was the critical, judgmental one towards them. But I was just afraid that if they saw through my masks, that they would take away the carefully crafted image that I've created of myself, that people might see who I really am and take away my acceptance, that they would reject me. You see how that works? Fear of men is always rooted in what they will take away from you. And so for Pharaoh, that's he fears people taking away his resources and his influence, his comfort and his security. For the Israelites, we're going to see later, they can fear men taking away their freedom or their well-being or even their very lives. And it doesn't always have to be physical. We fear people taking away our dignity and our acceptance. We fear that your husband will take away your love, your wife will take away your respect. We fear that people will take away our happiness. And so the fear of men is rooted in fear of what people will take away from us. And so in verse 11, he allows it to control him, and he responds by, you know what? Let's make these Israelites our slaves. Let's control them with guards and assign overwhelming burdens on them so that they can't have the strength. They're too busy to be able to do what they want. And it's ironic, this injustice, because he's enslaving them, it says in verse 11, to build up these store cities. Those are the very thing that God used to save Egypt from famine many years ago through Joseph when he interpreted Pharaoh's the previous Pharaoh's dreams to save them from famine, and not just the Israelites but all of Egypt. And he uses that. You see, you can always tell when someone's controlled by the fear of men, because the way that we respond to that is by attempting to control other people, to control the people that we're fearful of. Think of it this way. I'm afraid that people won't accept me as I am. So I control that by dressing a certain way, talking a certain way, acting a certain way, to control what they think about me or what they'll say about me. It's called image management, right? You see it on Facebook all the time. People don't usually post on Twitter or on Facebook there, I just woke up in the morning and here is my bedhead and my nasty, like, no makeup face, right? Very few people do that, unless you're really rich and famous, and that's like, anyway. But for most of us average Joes, we don't do stuff like that. We carefully craft our image to control other people, what they think, what they'll say about us. Sometimes, some of you are afraid to let people know that you go to church, or that you're a Christian, or maybe even to be able to pray before you eat, because your friends might give you a hard time. They might think that you're some religious weirdo, that they'll take away something from you, take away your acceptance. And so you control them by simply not praying. Or you do what I used to do when I first became a Christian. You know, I mentioned I became a Christian in college, and all of my friends around me were not Christians. They were all these stoner, like, weirdos and whatnot. And so I remember doing this kind of thing, like, okay, now I've become a Christian. I really want to pray to God and be thankful for what I have to eat. Oh, I have a headache. You're just thankful for food, everyone. And then to control what they think. I'm controlling them so that they think about me and treat me or talk about me in a certain way. And it was because I was afraid of taking a verbal punch for Jesus. Sometimes we're afraid to speak up about shady or unethical circumstances because we're afraid that people will think we're weak-willed, that we're soft, that we're not capable of making hard decisions. So we control what they think. We control them by just going along with the plan, just going with the flow. Some of us, we're afraid that someone is going to leave us. So we control them by checking up on them all the time, by stalking them online, or by getting angry at them frequently, by publicly humiliating them, by making threats to that person. You see, when you have a fear of men, If you allow that to control you, the outcome is that we will always try to control other people. And in verse 12, none of this injustice is a surprise to God. He prophesied to our boy Abe back in Genesis chapter 15, verse 13, you're going to be sojourners in Egypt. You're going to be slaves. You're going to be afflicted for 400 years. So despite Pharaoh reacting to his fear of men, despite his best efforts to control the situation, lest they multiply in verse 10, the more oppressed that they are, the more God blesses them, and they multiply anyway. And we need to see that regardless of circumstances and people, God can and does still bless in the midst of oppression. So we don't need to fear what man can do to us. So I want you to really ask the hard question of yourself, what am I afraid that someone's going to take from me? What are you afraid that someone's going to take away from you? And how do you let that fear of man control how you feel about yourself and your life? How does it control the choices you make and the actions that you take? Because the only power that people have is what you give to them. You see, someone sits on the throne of your heart, your mind, and your life. And if it's not Jesus, who is that? Over what area of your life? How you feel, what you say or do, where you go, whether or not you go to church? And now, let's do a self-check inventory. Do you worry a lot about what people feel about you, think about you, say about you? Do you have a recurring pattern of thinking that people are judging you, so I'm going to judge them first? Are you thin-skinned and bruised easily, yet angry quickly, because you take everything personal? That's a fear of man controlling you. Do you see feedback that people give you as an attack on your self-esteem instead of receiving it as a gift when people care about you and are trying to help you grow? And here's an interesting one. Here's a fear of man, one that sounds like opposite things. Are you attention-seeking because you need people to notice you because that means they love you? That's fear of man, because what they think of you controls you. Or are you attention-avoidant, where you make excuses all the time, you don't want to hang out with people because it's easier to avoid than to risk the awkwardness or the rejection that you might feel? Do you work 60 to 70 hours per week? Not just because you're industrious, not just because you love your job, but because you're driven by your performance. That's how you think people evaluate you. You are driven by what other people think of you. Fear of man. Some of us, we might say, I'm not controlled by any fear of man. I don't care what anyone thinks. Really. Your mask of being rebellious hides your insecurity very well. But I'm very familiar with it because I have it too. And you fear that you won't be accepted, so you preemptively strike. I will reject you before you can reject me. And you are a slave to fear that you can't trust anyone, so you keep everyone at a distance. For some of us, maybe you feel like you have difficulty connecting with people at church or in a fellowship or in a small group. And I want to tell you that your problem is the same thing, a fear of man. I'm not talking about you don't come to church because you're lazy, you're tired, or busy, whatever. But when you actually come and you have difficulty connecting with people, you see, we don't connect with people because we're afraid that they're going to judge us, when we should only fear the one with the authority to judge. His name is Jesus. We're afraid to put ourselves out there to be authentic and vulnerable because we're afraid that people will take away our mask of image management and acceptance, of respect or pride. We're afraid that it'll cost us something, that it requires commitment to be present, to be safe and supportive of imperfect people in the process of growth in Christ, that we'll have to get involved, that they might see our blind spots, and they might actually love us enough to challenge us to grow in those areas. You have difficulty connecting in the body of Christ because you're afraid, and so you miss out because you hold out. And I know this because I've sat in on every single fellowship at the Crossing, and I have to tell you, they're great people. They're humble, foolish, broken, imperfect, recovering sinners, just like you and I. So it's not the people that are the problem. If we're disconnected, it's not everyone else. Maybe it's me. And most likely, the root is that we bow to a fear of man. Let's look at the end of this passage, picking up from verse 15. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it's a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and let the male children live? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they're vigorous and give birth before the midwife even comes to them. So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. We're going to stop right there for today. So what's happening here is that because Pharaoh couldn't control them simply by enslaving the Hebrew people, he enacts part two of his plan, which in verse 15 is that he coerces these Hebrew women, these Hebrew midwives, they're people who assist with the delivery of babies, to collaborate with him. Their names are Shiphrah and Puah by name. These two are kind of like the head nurses over all the Hebrew midwives. It wasn't just like over a million people that there's only two nurses to help give birth, okay? And in verse 16, he gives them a command. If it's a baby girl, if it's a Maddie, let her live. Because they might serve as a future slave or a concubine or a maid. And they definitely won't be a soldier against us. You remember Pharaoh's fear earlier on in the passage? But if it's a baby boy, if it's an Indy, kill him. And we see here the beginnings of a selective infanticide, which is really a genocide against the Hebrew people. Because Pharaoh is controlled by his fear of the Hebrews, he tries to control them by putting these two women in the same position. And the question for them is, are you going to be more afraid of men or of God? And in verse 17 it says, they feared God. In great trust and obedience to God, they commit an act of civil disobedience and allow these baby boys to live. You see, when the laws of men contradict the laws of God, God's holiness and his authority overrule them. And so what we're going to see here from their example is that the way that you and I can overcome fear of men is with the fear of God. Shouldn't these two be afraid of what Pharaoh can do to them? Of course, he's the king. They disobeyed a direct order from him. He can have them killed. But because they know enough about God, his truth, his word, his will, they know enough about him to recognize the difference between right and wrong. And they fear violating the holiness of God more than what a Pharaoh can do to them. You see, fear of God is based on knowing the truth of God revealed in his word. And what Luke chapter 12, verse 4 and 5 tells us, actually I'm going to read it for you real quick. Jesus says something very interesting that's kind of similar to that. You don't have to turn there. Let me just read it for you. Luke chapter 12, I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who can kill the body, and after that have nothing more that they can do, but I will warn you whom to fear. Fear him who after he has killed has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies, and not one of them is forgotten before God? Why, even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not. You are of more value than many sparrows. What Jesus is saying there is, you know, don't fear people. The worst that they can do to you is kill you. That's it. And I know for many of us, well, that's sort of a big deal. You know, breathing is on my to-do list. I like to be able to continue checking that box. But Jesus is saying, all they can do is kill you. Well, Jesus, is there something worse than death? And Jesus says, yes, you can face the judgment of an almighty, all-powerful, all-holy God who's all-knowing, so our excuses and our blame-shifting and our rationalization won't distract him from whether or not we feared and worshiped and served God or someone or something else. You see, people will say and do harmful things to you. And Jesus says, don't be afraid of even losing your life. If you're going to be a Christian, you've got to be willing to die for Jesus if it comes to that, or to even live for Jesus, because sometimes living for him is just as hard as dying for him because we fear so much what people will say or think or do. But we got to be willing to do both of those things. And in the rest of that passage, in verse 6 and 7, Jesus says, in our healthy dose of godly fear, to know that God who takes care of sparrows, who knows the number of hairs that are growing out of your head, or lack thereof, loves you so much more than those little things, because the fear of God is based on the love of God. You see, if you know that God loves you, even if what happens to you is not good or holy or just, then it'll be used by a good and holy and just God to teach you more about Jesus and to make you more like him, Romans chapter 8, verse 28 and 29 tells us. And so we overcome the fear of men with the love of God, that God loves me one way or the other. I'm going to get through this. And so returning back to our passage in Exodus, in verse 18, I want you to know that some time has passed. It's a jump in time, possibly years, long enough for new babies to be born and for several boys to be identified. And the population is increasing, and so what happens here is Pharaoh is livid. He calls for a private session with these two commoner Hebrew slave women to appear before him as their king and master. Why have you disobeyed me? You see, there comes a moment where we face a test. Do you really fear God or fear men? And this is what the test looks like when the consequences to our godly choices and actions come to light. When the godly choices you make have consequences that you have to face, that's when you really find out, do you fear God or do you fear men? When you have to face the music. These two women, they could have run. They could have tried to escape. They don't. They could have lied or covered it up with excuses. You said babies? I thought you said rabies. Oh, we're so sorry. We clearly misunderstood or misheard what you were saying. I'm so sorry, Pharaoh, right? Or, you know what? We did command all the junior midwives to kill any boys that were born. They disobeyed, not us. Or, you know what? Pharaoh, you're mistaken. There's no new boys. These are just very burly girls. The population hasn't increased. It's just your imagination, right? They could have covered it up. And in verse 19, some people perhaps misinterpret that these women are lying to Pharaoh. They're kind of covering things up. Except that we know in Proverbs chapter 12, verse 22, that the Lord detests lying lips. And in verse 20, God actually shows his approval of them. So what's happening there? Well, if you've read the Bible all the way through, you often see that there's quite a bit of humor in it, that Jesus will often tell parables, right? And there's always a punchline, usually at the expense of Pharisees. And so here's Shiphrah and Puah. They're standing before the king. They're facing the consequences, and you see how much they do not fear men, not even a king, because they look him right in the eye, and they crack a joke. They took a shot at the Egyptians. Sorry, Pharaoh. Hebrew women must just be better at birthing than Egyptians. What are you going to do, right? That must be why the midwives, we keep arriving too late to prevent these boys from being born. And the result in verse 20 and 21 is that God blesses their trust and fear and obedience. We see that Israelites continue to multiply and grow strong, and the midwives, they themselves are blessed with children of their own. And the point isn't, oh, if you fear God, then he gives you stuff. That's not the point. The point here is that nothing could stop God's sovereign will, his sovereign plan for the growth of Israel, for the people of Israel to multiply. Not kings, not slavery, not oppression, not plans of genocide. And that he even bothers to bless the busy hands of these women, his instruments, to bring kids into this world with children of their own, because he is a gracious God. Whatever pain or struggle or consequence that you are facing from men, you need to hear this. Those things are temporary. And you can't see it yet, but you need to trust and serve and worship and obey a God who keeps all of his promises, that all of them are yes and amen. We see that throughout the history of the Bible. When Joseph was in charge of a household, he was the number two guy in the guy's household, and he could have taken this moment where the guy's wife, the owner of the house, who's his master, wants to sleep with him, wants to have sex with him. And, you know, he could simply just, you know what, master doesn't have to find out, I'll just sleep with her and get away with it, and then nothing bad will happen. But he chooses to fear God, and by his integrity, face the consequences that he knew that the master wouldn't believe his words, and he gets thrown, cast into prison. We saw that with this young woman named Esther, who is the favored queen of Persia, except that she's a Hebrew woman. And the command had gone out into the land that all the Hebrew people would be killed. And she could have remained quiet and not revealed who she is or what her background is and just remained the queen. But she feared God. And so she spoke up. And God used that. We see that with Shifra and Pua here. And we see that in many of your lives, in all the little areas. Sometimes it's going to be big things. Sometimes it's going to be small things. But the question is, do you fear God or do you fear men? A couple of years ago, I've shared with some of you who've been around for a while, I got asked to meet with some people, and I want you to be perfectly honest with you, okay? It wasn't my intent to go, but it actually turned out to be an interview, and I didn't know that it was going to be an interview. It's like some people wanted to talk about, you know, pastoring and leadership, but I got this phone call, and it turned out to be an interview with this very large church, even though they knew that I was already a pastor in another church. And this church, they basically said, you know what? We've been asking around about you. We've been talking to a lot of the professors in your seminary that you graduated from. They have a lot of good things to say about you. We've talked to other pastors, so we've kind of checked your references already without you offering any. Talked to pastors in the Bay Area that know you. We have had our whole leadership team listening to your sermons online, and I was wondering, how come we have so many hits on some of our sermons online? Now I know, like, why? Because usually we don't have that many. And we really feel like that you are our guide, that God wants you to come and be pastor over our church. And I said, well, you know, I'm already a pastor. Well, we'll make it a little bit easier for you. What we really need is a teaching pastor, and so all you would have to do is prepare sermons or any other project that you want to do. Oh, so I wouldn't have to do a lot of the other work that I have to do? And the church, by the way, is over 1,000 people. So your influence could spread much wider than you think. And the leadership team, they're all behind it. The decision's already made. All you have to do is say yes. I had a choice in that moment. And it's interesting because here's how fear of man came to play. I like when people tell me that I do a good job. I like when people like me, don't you? And I like when people give me what I want. I like the idea of being able to take care of my family. And so there's this whole fear of man in that I want the approval of people, or I'm fearful that what if I can't take care of my wife and kids for the future? And so that there's that part. And then there's the fear that, you know what, though? There's a church that I serve in that I love the people. I've poured out my life, not just as a pastor here for over 7 years full-time, but even before that, 10 other years in youth ministry on a part-time and volunteer basis. This is the church where I grew up in, and that I came to know Jesus. And there's a fear in me of men that, you know, what would people think? I know what I would think if somebody did that at our church, right? We would wrestle with that. And then as I was praying through it, and trying to weigh all these pros and cons and this and that, I realized it can't be either of those reasons why you make a decision. It can't be the fear of men at this other church. It can't even be the fear of those people that you love and hold most dear in your own church. But what does God want from you? Because either way, you're trying to base your decision on what other people think to control you, to control the choice that I make and the actions that I take. And I knew what God wanted. It's not that I don't want to see us evangelize and grow into a big church, but I don't need it handed to me on a silver platter already. And I knew that God had called me to be here in this city of Hayward, not to be in a very wealthy city where they paid a very wealthy salary. I know what God desires. And the question is, do I fear Him more than I fear what people think? Or am I controlled by what people say? And so for you this morning, I want you to think about, big or small, what are areas of your life this morning where you have to make a choice? Whether you're going to trust and fear God or you're going to fear and be controlled by men. What is that area? We looked at two case studies this morning. Humble Hebrew midwives who are slaves. And also a king over a nation. And it makes more sense. The likely prediction or outcome of this story is that the weak people in the story should be the ones who fear men more. But it turns out it's the mighty one with with all the power, with all the influence, who is the real slave, a slave to fear of men. And now these two groups, God doesn't bother to even record the name of this king of Egypt. It's long forgotten. But he gives these two commoners great honor. Their names make it into the Bible. How would you like that? Preserved throughout all of history as women who feared the Lord because they chose to worship and serve and honor God above men. Before the Israelites can encounter the God of glory, what we see here at the beginning is that before he delivers them from physical slavery, God deals with the slavery of the heart. These two women had to decide, will we trust and obey and fear God, or are we going to trust and fear men? And in all of our lives, we will have to make that same binary choice. It's either one or the other. If you fear men, you cannot fear God. If you fear God, you cannot fear men. And if you're going to encounter the God of glory who sets us free to worship him, to become his people, then you can only be subject to and serve one or the other. Many of us sitting here this morning, we're slaves to the fear of men, hopefully in the process of being set free. And it starts with answering the question, who do you fear? Let's pray.